Keystone report. There's going to be sort of a tag team on this. I will start off. Chris is going to make some comments. Pat is going to make some comments. And then George Darcy is going to give us a presentation. The information for the part that I am going to discuss is behind tab 1, and it is item 3, which is the Executive Committee summary. And if you go to page 51 out of 57, is the draft straw man for the New England Fisheries vision. I'm not going to read through the whole vision statement. The suggestions that were made at the previous meeting have all been incorporated into this. It was an item that was discussed at the executive committee meeting. We had initially thought that we would go ahead and take some action on it at this meeting, but our feeling is that we need to do more in terms of outreach to the industry and to the public and to get some more input into this. And our feeling was that we should have a series of public meetings on this to get direct feedback from the industry. It will also be up on the council website with a request there for electronic feedback if people would like to do it in that format. We do not currently have a schedule of when and where the public meetings will be, but that will get crafted in the near future. I don't know if people have had a chance to take a look at it and have any comments or questions on what was added to it. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Rip. Would you identify the spot where we can find that? You mentioned a page. I didn't catch that.
It's under tab 1, and then you go to item number 3, which is the executive committee meeting summary. And if you scroll down through that, it's page, there are 57 pages. It's 51 out of 57.
I got a hard copy, so.
You got a hard copy.
I'll have to scroll down.
You're going to have to, you have to flip through those. You don't scroll through those. Any thoughts on that? Well, Mary Beth.
This is a draft, from what I understand, and there is going to be some meetings, as you referred to. What would be the structure of the meetings to present this as a draft to the public and just initiate a discussion or just get feedback? I mean, have been much thought given to that yet?
Well, the objective is to get feedback on what we're proposing, from which I assume we either say we're going in the right direction or we need to look at fine-tuning it. If there aren't any more comments, we'll jump to the second item under the Touchstone Report, which the actual order is getting changed a little bit. That's why I said it was going to be a tag team. I think we're going to Chris, and then we'll go to George.
Okay. I was just going to speak to some of the Touchstone recommendations on communications. Right after the document that Rip referred to under the Executive Committee materials, which is document number 5, is a memo from Paul Howard to the Council dated November 7th. And it basically describes the prioritization of the response on communications that the Executive Committee recommended. There's basically a list of suggestions from Touchstone, and to accomplish the tasks, a list was compiled by the Council staff and presented to the Executive Committee in August, and recommendations were subsequently presented to the full Council in September. And at that time, the Council asked the Executive Committee to prioritize the list and move forward. So there's a final list which reflects the Executive Committee decisions. At its November 3rd meeting, many of the approved activities are in process or will begin at the January 12th Council meeting. Then there were two basic Touchstone recommendations that these responded to. One was to maximize collaboration and redesign key elements to be more collaborative. The second main recommendation was to simplify communications, redesign communications to meet stakeholder needs. So in that memo, there are a number of recommendations presented. I won't go through them all. I'll just highlight some, starting with the top priorities, which were to convene at least one super meeting annually with all advisors and SSC members, two, hold collaborative working sessions at the oversight committee level to tackle problematic management issues, three, invite sector managers, representatives to provide reports to the council, four, serve coffee during two set 30-minute breaks on each council meeting day. I think got to start on that one. Organize an informal social hour that will be open to council members, staff, and stakeholders, and any interested members of the public on the second night of most council meetings. I don't want to just read through the rest of the list, so I'm going to just skip over to the second major item, which was to simplify communications. Some of these recommendations were establish an ad hoc working group to determine where improvements should be made, activities modified, or new initiatives developed. Develop principles to guide all communications, and those principles will include objectivity, inclusiveness, and clarity with respect to purpose and content. Then there's a subsequent list below that represents some initiatives that have not yet been addressed to date but will be incorporated into the staff and administrative communications functions and duties as soon as possible. Those are to create a clear and informative navigating the council process document, fully support the NOAA NIMS plain language initiative, develop and implement a council communication plan. Anyway, I'll let council members read through the rest of the list, but if there are any questions about those, Rip, I could answer them, or Pat Fiorelli.
Any questions from the council? Dave Gaethel.
Well, actually, I just have a comment, something I'd like to see added to the list. My wife went to a listening session on communication in Hampton recently. I wasn't there. I was unloading. But one of the things that was discussed was the fact that the public really doesn't know who we are. And by we, I mean the council staff, the NIMF staff. They don't know the people in the room. You know, we get these little cards here, but quite frankly, I get put on either set of glasses I got. I can't read the ones across the way. I don't know who's who. You know, I know the people because I'm part of the process. But for the average person in the public to come in here and sit down, they don't know who in this audience is NIMF staff, who's council staff, who's who. And it was recommended that a very simple solution is for people to wear name tags. And it identifies you as, say, a council member, NIMF staff, council staff, whatever. And then when you approach somebody to ask them a question, it's not, hey, you, because you don't know their name. It's, hey, Dave, or hey, whoever, so they can at least start a conversation. And I noticed the executive committee nixed the idea, and I'd like to put it back on the table because I think it's a good idea. And I don't think wearing a name tag is an unnecessary burden.
As a new council member, I would just echo those same sentiments. It was difficult to be here in the beginning and not know people's faces. And when we have a fully School of Fish four times a year, Peter and I, even though we're the owners, we wear a name tag through the entire thing. I think it's just helpful, and I think you're right, it does make council members more approachable.
Captain. Did they take away your microphone and gave you a name tag? Anything else to add? And perhaps, you know, I mean, from the standpoint of somebody that doesn't come up to greet you, the name tags aren't any more visible than these ones are. And we can do something as basic as just introducing ourselves around the table at the start of every day, too. Just and then people in the audience should get a better understanding over time as to who we are.
But I think it's more than that, Rip. I mean, there's staff here. People don't know who the staff are. And you know, in a corporation, staff wear a name tag. And I don't see why we're any different, really. I mean, I think that, you know, it says, Pat Fiorelli, council staff, George Darcy, NIMF staff, something like that. It just lets people know who you work for, and then if they have a question, they can ask you. And if you're not the person that can answer their question, they can walk you over to another staff person, and it just gets the ball moving. I mean, for those of us who are here more or less constantly, it's not terribly intimidating. But for somebody that walks in the door and sits down in the back of the room and says, my God, I got no idea who anybody is, it puts you on the defensive right off the bat. You're not likely to approach somebody if you don't know their name.
Dr. Pierce and Doug.
Yeah, I'll pile on. We had the annual meeting of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission last week, and I wore my tag with a nice lanyard for 4 or 5 days. And I, therefore, was easily identified, and I was approached quite often with people addressing me by my name, and I didn't know who they were, so we get to talk. It's a good thing to do. I think it's a good suggestion. It's a minor inconvenience for council members and for staff. It makes us more easily identifiable and, yes, I think, more approachable.
Doug.
Yeah, Dave mentioned one of the things I was going to say. The other thing is if we can't read these, the audience can't read these, so maybe it's time to have bigger nameplates here. Going around the table would only help if someone in the audience was here at the beginning of the meeting and if they come in halfway through. So, you know, I guess I agree that at least we need to make some kind of effort to make us more recognizable, at least our names more easily recognizable. And whether it's with name tags or bigger name plates, and, you know, I think Dave's idea of having you know, council staff with some kind of a name tag or nameplate would be helpful too, as well as any NIMS staff in the audience. So,
Dave Prebble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think that that name tags are probably a good idea, but I just don't want the ones that have the big button that says "Hello, my name is," and I don't want the ones that make holes in my expensive shirts either.
We'll work on that. Anyone else on that? Oh, Laura.
Not to belabor it, but just wondering, because you were saying that if we went around and introduced, but sometimes people come when the agenda item that they're interested in is up, would it make sense to just have a list of council members and their positions as part of the handouts outside that someone could grab if they were interested in knowing who was sitting at the table?
Anyone else on this item? You're through? Okay. Next, we'll go to George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a PowerPoint, which I think will be up in a minute. There's also a copy of it in that same package of documents in document number 3, tab 1, and a copy of the draft operating agreement, which is what this is all about. Hopefully you've had a chance to at least take a quick look at it to get a sense of what's in there. Okay, this is still a draft, obviously, but our intent is to ultimately have this be a signed agreement with the parties to be this council, our regional office, the Fishery Science Center, NOAA, Office of General Counsel in the Northeast, Gene's office, and the NOAA Fisheries Service Office of Law Enforcement in the Northeast. And by the way, we're hoping to do a similar agreement with the Mid-Atlantic Council, and we're just beginning that process as well. The purpose of the operating agreement, there are many, actually. It first confirms the mutual interest of all the parties in trying to work through a complicated process to come out with good outcomes for everyone and the public, obviously. It also clarifies roles and responsibilities, and if you did look at the operating agreement, you'll see that a lot of the text in there is relative to that subject. It tries to define who everyone is, what their jobs are, what roles they play in the process. It would hopefully also provide for improved planning through primarily the action plan, which will be the subject of much of the rest of my talk, and I hope that will be clear why that document should improve the planning. It should help ensure compliance with applicable law, of which there are many. It would explicitly consider opportunities for simplification of the regulations, again, to primarily through the action plan. It would force a look at existing regulations to see if they're still necessary and if an additional action could actually supersede something or make something clearer or simpler. It should establish greater accountability for all the players in the process in terms of getting any given action done with a good outcome and on time. It's intended also to make the process more transparent and accessible to the public. Again, I'll explain how it would do that in a few minutes. It should encourage constructive collaboration between all of the parties as well as with the public. And it should help in managing expectations, both among the council members and members of the public in terms of what to expect and when to expect it. This is a document that actually we started working on an earlier draft several years ago in response to a national program to try to, it was primarily focused at the NEPA process and trying to have a more measured process for all the councils to complete their work in a way that ensured a strong analysis and a good approvable outcome. However, it's been revised significantly because it also is intended to meet a lot of the issues that came up in the management review, and I think there are a number of ways, particularly through the action plan, that can be done. Among those are, again, better understanding of the roles and responsibilities of everyone, what's everyone's job, better understanding of the entire development process. For every action, there are a number of steps that have to be gone through, and there's a timeline to do that. A better understanding and agreement among all the parties on what the timelines for a given action are. More accountability for all the players to make sure that things get done and get done when they're supposed to get done. It should help the council also have a stronger prioritization process so that when they're looking at competing actions and limited resources and looking at ways that these things interact, the action plan should help them clarify what those intersections are. As I mentioned earlier, there's more focus on opportunities for simplification of the regulations and better public information for timely and effective involvement in the process. There were a number of comments received as a result of management review that indicated that people were confused sometimes about the process, when was the best time to get engaged, how to do that, what their opportunities were at various stages, and this should help remedy that. So I'm going to focus now largely on the action plan, which is there's a template of that as an attachment to the draft operating agreement. And I think this is the piece of the agreement that actually goes to addressing a number of the issues. So the action plan is something that under this agreement would be required for each action that the council undertakes. And by that I mean a framework, specification, new FMP or an FMP amendment. It would serve as a planning and a public informational tool. And it essentially would be a contract among the parties. And among the parties here, primarily we're talking about the people who are engaged through the PDT, the people who are actually going to get the technical work done, provide the analyses, put the documents together. It's a way of coming to agreement early on in the process as to who's going to do what their role is going to be, when it's going to be done, and then hold people accountable for that. And it's intended to be a living document. It's something that, although it's formulated at the very beginning of the development of an action, obviously things happen through time, and it should be updated and made available to the public throughout the process until the action is actually approved by the council and implemented by No Fisheries Service, so the public knows and the council knows and staff know exactly what that status is and if it's changed, and if it's changed, why. In terms of its preparation, it's intended to be prepared by the PDT with involvement by all of the disciplines that might need to be brought to bear for a particular action. And that includes the science, the management, legal, enforcement, data, protected resources, habitat, and so forth. As you all know, there's a wide range of issues that can come up associated with any given action. So the idea would be that at the beginning of the action, all of the parties who might have an interest in it or might have a role to play would be brought together either for an initial meeting or it could be done through a call or some combination of that to discuss what the council is intending to do and who might need to be involved and what issues may come up. And we'll also identify who needs to be further involved in the process in order to get all those things addressed. After that, not all the disciplines would necessarily have to be involved. Obviously, there's a wide range of types of actions that the council undertakes. Some of them are very focused on a certain aspect, and they may not need full input by all of these other disciplines. But some of them are quite complicated and have a lot of alternatives of various kinds and may need a larger group. The action plan, once it's prepared by the PDT, would then be approved by the executive committee, and if the executive committee does approve it, it will be brought before the full council for their information and approval as well. If in the course of developing the action plan, which, as I mentioned, is supposed to be essentially a contract as to who's going to do what, if there is a conflict, if there's not an agreement as to who can do something at a particular time when it might be needed, and that can't be resolved by staff through the PDT, the executive committee would then have a role to try to resolve that issue and either change the timing of the action, bring more resources to bear, change priorities, or whatever it might take to make sure that there was agreement before that action proceeded. In terms of the contents, again, there's a skeleton template as an attachment to the draft operating agreement. But it would contain a statement of the problem that the council is trying to solve and the council's objectives in taking the action, a range of alternatives to be considered, and at the beginning of the development of the action, obviously we're not going to be talking about detailed alternatives as you are farther down the road as the PDT and the committee does its work. This would be a general sense of what kind of actions you're going to be looking at. Is it time area closures? Is it gear change? Is it reporting requirements? It could be as broad as that. It would identify who's going to serve on the PDT after that first meeting and the responsibilities of each. Is there going to be a data requirement to produce something? Is there going to be a stock assessment requirement? Is there going to be a habitat assessment that needs to be done? Who's going to do it, and when is it going to be needed in order to keep the action on track? There also would be an initial decision on what type of NEPA analysis would be done. Would it need to be an EIS? Could it be an EA or even a categorical exclusion, a CE? There would be a rundown of all the applicable laws and issues associated with those laws that might be associated with that action and how they're going to be addressed. There would be an initial look at the possibility of there being enforcement issues or concerns that would need to be tracked throughout the development. Likewise, data issues. What data are going to be needed? When are they going to be available? What time series of data are going to be possible or desirable to be used? And there would be an explicit look at the regulatory clarification, simplification possibilities that might arise because of the action. Are there things that are in the regulations that are no longer necessary that we could get rid of? Are there things that could be done in a more cost-effective or simpler way? And finally, there would be a timeline and a flowchart developed for each action, which would lay out for the council and for the public exactly what to expect and when to expect it. As I mentioned, one of the benefits of this, I think, is certainly intended to be that it is a way that the public can get better information right from the beginning of the development of the action all the way through to its implementation. The action plan, once approved, would be posted on the council's website, so it's easily reached by the public. We would provide at least links to it from our own website, so anyone going to either site looking for what's coming up on Monkfish, for example, would be, clearly be able to find that document. There would be a flowchart that would illustrate graphically the process and the timing. What are the major events that are going to occur in that development and implementation, and when will it occur? And there would be explicit guidance to inform the public when and how they should best be involved. Is it going to a meeting? Is it providing written comments on a rule? Trying to get through that confusion that the public seems to feel now as to when they can best be involved and what their appropriate role is at that point in the process. The action plans would be included in the council binders for every meeting for which there is an action on the agenda for that particular action. And under the discussion at a council meeting for that action, the review of the action plan would be the first item on that agenda topic. So that the public knows and the council knows, are we on track? Has there been a change? Does there need to be a change? What is the change? How will it affect people? How will it affect the implementation of that action? And what are the implications? And finally, to kind of close the loop on this, there would be a checklist that would essentially track through all of the items that are in the action plan that would be completed by the PDT prior to bringing that final, action to the council for final council action, to ensure that all the applicable laws, all the issues, all the necessary pieces of that action have been completed, or completed enough for council to take its action, and then it can be finalized after that. And it would also document that there was an explicit look at regulatory simplification opportunities associated with that action. So that completes the presentation, and be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Can I just make a couple of comments before you do that? So this is a draft, and we're still early in the process of developing this draft. We're interested in your comments on it and your feedback on it. We're also talking about trying to find some ways to better engage the public in discussions about the draft. The operating agreement is intended to be directly responsive to the recommendations in the management review having to do with confusion over the process, confusion over roles and responsibilities. So we thought this was at least one way to try to get at that, and probably not the only way that we need to work on. So this is going to, I suspect this will change a lot in the next several weeks, and I think it's very likely that the council will see it again at your January-February meeting. And with any luck, it may be at a point then we'd be talking about signing it. But for right now, it's still very much a draft, and we're looking for input.
Pat or George, this in terms of the presentation is a essentially the first time most of the council members, have seen it. And I know that in my case, I think sometimes you see these things, then you have to think about them for a while before you have some ideas. Is there a process that you have thought of in terms of how the council might respond to you over the next several weeks? Should they be sending thoughts via email or...
I think that would be helpful, and you can certainly send an email to either me or George or both. I hope that as we think more about getting better engagement on discussions about this, that there'll be additional opportunities for the council to comment. But I would say that if you have the opportunity to read it now, if you've got comments, please send them now, and we can get them incorporated early in the process.
One comment and a question. I think if you send comments to George or Pat, please copy them to Rip and Paul. The other is, Pat, you had talked about perhaps a public comment period on this at one time. Are you still considering that?
We are still considering that, but haven't finalized how best to do this, and this may actually be something we end up using the Touchstone for, to get their help on getting comment on this.
Yeah, I think the other thing is we're envisioning that at some point there would be an assessment of how this, assuming we go forward with this or something like it, that a year from now or 18 months from now or at some appropriate time, we would take another look to see if it's working. or if there are ways it could work better. This isn't intended to become a big burdensome process. We want to keep it as simple as possible to achieve the objectives we're trying to achieve. So I don't think whatever we do initially probably will be the absolute best that we can do.
Anyone have any comments at this point? Doug?
As far as keeping it as simple as possible but still improving things, it seems like we already have sort of a framework for these action plans and our timelines here, which lays out specific things that need to be done by a certain date and checked off. The action plan would just have a lot more meat on it, as I interpret this whole thing. So we sort of have the framework for this already. Is that the way you envisioned it?
Yes. To the extent that we can use things that are already working, that would be great. One of the things that would be added to that is more explicit instructions to the public as to how and where to get involved and make these things more available and have this more routine discussion in front of the public and with the council so that everybody knows what's happening and knows what to expect. And if things have changed, people are aware of that early on so that they can adjust to that.
Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Responding to Pat's comment, this was generated by the 175 interviews that Touchstone did, and I really would strongly agree with what you had said, how important it is to run this back through that process to make sure at a minimum, by the time you're done doing all this work, at least those 175 people will see an improvement and will think that this addresses the concerns. So those comments were, as one of the interview persons were, I think, supposed to be somewhat anonymous, but hopefully there's a shield there that allows you to access them in some way to get their input. And I encourage you, it sounds like you're trying to do that, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, George, in your presentation on slide 6, you noted that the action plan preparation will involve all the disciplines, and in particular, I note that there's an inclusion of legal. And Gene is sitting to my right, so that immediately caught my attention. Glad to see that that's in there, because it seems to me that there needs to be more emphasis on that aspect of what we do, specific to action plan preparation now. With that said, I assume that on page 16 of the document that you just reviewed, where it relates to responsibilities of the Regional Office of Sustainable Fisheries Division, that the turning to Gene and others to get legal advice, that would relate to the sixth bullet down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, where it says potential approvability issues. Is that where the focus would be relative to action plans highlighting or including the involvement of the legal discipline? Or does it go beyond that?
I think it goes beyond that. I think the involvement of legal at the action plan development stage is, for example, if the council had in mind that they were going to go down a particular road and it turned out you didn't have statutory authority to do that, it would be good to know that right away rather than spend months trying to develop something and then at that point find out that you can't get there from here without a change to the Magnuson Act or something like that. Also, to make sure that any of the applicable laws that are going to come into play, that there aren't any special issues that are going to come up there, to help with the determination of what kind of NEPA document might be appropriate. That kind of question those are the issues that are likely to come up early in the process. The approvability issues, I think, tend to come up later as you go through and start to consider specific alternatives. And certainly at that point, you'd want feedback from legal as well as the agency if we were seeing problems there.
Okay, so then we would be in a better position through action plans to get an early indication of whether or not there'd be some problems with the national standard compliance. Okay, that would be very desirable. All right. I assume that because NOAA Fisheries is sued so often that wouldn't put you in a difficult position. You know what I mean? It's a good thing. I'm just wondering to what extent you'll be able to move forward and provide that kind of legal advice from the beginning in light of all of the potentials for lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, Gene might want to answer this too, but part of the point of this is so that we don't get sued. We don't go down a path that is either very risky or maybe not even possible. So by looking at these things early on and making sure we're thinking about all the facets of this, hopefully we would get to a point where either we wouldn't get sued, or if we did, we'd have a very good record to win.
Okay, thank you. That's a good clarification. Having a good record, a good written record, will go a long way towards helping us to avoid pitfalls. Thanks.
Dave Gaten.
Yeah, George, I actually applaud you and whoever else worked on this for the vision. I mean, you've taken Touchstone's vision and put it into concrete terms, and I appreciate that. I look at the slide, I think it's 5, and it says contract among the parties. So to me, that implies a contract implies something to negotiate before you sign. And I'm glad we're going to have a couple of months to have that negotiation, because there are some things that I would like to know, and I certainly can't find out right at the moment. So, for example, how does this affect the staff's workloads? I mean, does this shift workloads around so that, you know, some people are now more burdened and others less so? I'd kind of like to hear reports from all the parties involved in this to see how they envision that this is going to work. So, for example, the sustainability staff, the legal staff, the council staff, everybody kind of weigh in here and let us know if they have some ideas about suggested changes or anything. The last thing I'd like to say is I do think that somehow we have to involve the public in commenting on this, because ultimately it's the public that's the most affected. And so with that said, I don't know whether we put it on the agenda for the next council meeting to take a period of public comment or how we go about it, but I think before we finalize this, that the public ought to be able to weigh in with whether they think it's the proper way to proceed or not, and also if they have ideas for changes or possible streamlining or anything. So I would make that as a suggestion that we let the public know this document exists and, you know, at some point, you know, request their comment in an official capacity. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's exactly what we're intending. This is, you know, we actually started with council staff and then went to the executive committee and now the council, but with the caveat that it's still an early draft in all those cases, and at some point we do need to find a way to engage the public in the discussion. So that's absolutely our intent.
Good. I mean that's, we just got it yesterday, and the full document's a pretty lengthy document, and it's got an awful lot of stuff in it, and I haven't really thought about some of those items, and I might have some comments, but I suspect the public will actually have quite a bit of comment, because it does change fairly substantially the way we do business.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess as we, and I'd echo Dave's sentiments that we need to have some process by which to gather those comments. It seems like that's the plan at this point. I guess we need to balance all of this, and I think the objectives of what's gone into this document are widely shared. But we need to balance all of this against the additional amount of time it's going to take us to do some of these management actions, especially something like a framework. Because as I look through this, it represents a tremendous amount of work by a lot of people who already have a tremendous amount on their plate. I think ideally it's streamlining a process, but there's new work here. And I'd like to see, as we move forward, estimates for how much longer something like this or creating and managing and updating these types of plans actually adds to the turnaround time on frameworks and amendments, because I don't think it will be trivial.
I don't think that's the case. It's certainly not intended to be the case. I know when you look at all these details, it does sound like a lot, but I think a lot of this already takes place. This formalizes it, and I think front loads it more. The action plan itself, I'd envisioned anyway, being only a few pages long. It's not intended to be a great big document. It's to get things down, get things started, get people thinking about things, get them on the same page, and making sure that the executive committee, the council, and the public know what's coming up. So it's not intended to be a lot of work. I think it might be a little bit more. But you might ultimately save time if you avoid pitfalls that if you had a false start, or if you went down a road that wasn't going to be fruitful, and this was able to prevent that from happening, you might ultimately come out in a better place. And also, it might be better for everybody to understand it is going to take longer than you might have thought it was going to take. This happens all the time with actions that, the council would like to have something done, or we would like to have something done in, 9 months, and it ends up taking 14. Well, there might have been good reasons for that, but it would have been good along the way for people to understand that was happening and why it was happening, and possibly have junctures where the council could have made conscious choices about deploying resources, or us for that matter, to make it happen faster at the expense of something else if they wanted to make that decision. So it's to try to make this more transparent so everybody understands what's happening and why.
Sorry, just to follow up to that, so that I understand it clearly, the action plan would be developed prior to essentially the formal initiation of the work on the document, the work by the committee addressing a specific problem. I don't know then who or how that actually works in practice in terms of identifying measures and potential alternatives or the types of analyses that will be included in the document, let alone the problems to be addressed. I think the struggles we've had with the Monkfish Amendment to date have been that the committee, through an open process and engagement with the advisory panel, has been struggling with just those questions. So I'm not sure who then preempts that entire process by identifying both the problems and the tools we're going to use to address them. Would that be staff?
Yeah, that actually came up at the executive committee same way. I think that Monkfish Amendment is somewhat an outlier. Normally, the council would identify a problem, have some idea how they wanted to solve it, what would be the range of measures that they're going to consider in taking that action. So this is really focused on what I would consider the more normal type of amendment. There may be things like that are more of a, you go through a visioning or a development process, a scoping, something where you're not quite sure what you're going to do or even if you're going to do it. So in that case, you might have to have a little different process and wait till you got to that point where you really defined your problem and objectives, and at that point go to this action plan.
Just one last point, and not to belabor it, but I think given the fact that this morning we identified or altered the alternatives in a document that the council's been working on for 6 years indicates that perhaps monkfish is not a unique case in that this is it's very difficult almost regardless of the action to at the outset identify the full range of alternatives or even a broad range of alternatives that or tools that we'd use. Just something that we'll consider. I'm sure it'll be included in the comments.
Yeah, that's come up before, and I agree with you. I mean, it's not at all unusual for during the development of something, an action, that it takes a jog. Something else comes up. Something else is intended to be added. But again, because this action plan is supposed to be a living document, it should be able to accommodate that. Now, at that point, you'd have the discussion that, you know, the timeline might have to change. But again, I think better for everybody to have that discussion and know it and know what the change is going to be when it's happening, rather than being disappointed in the public expecting something's going to be implemented in fishing year 2013 and it's really going to be 2014.
Just to add to that a little bit, I don't envision that the way this process would work that we would be at the point of developing an action plan for monkfish yet. So it's not that the PDT doesn't exist and it's not that they're not working on things, but before you have an action plan, you've actually got to get to the point where you have a defined action. So I don't think you'd be quite there on monkfish yet for doing an action plan. And on herring and the changes we made this morning, I don't think the changes we made this morning would change the action plan unless it changes the timeline. And if it does change the timeline, then I would argue that this process makes that change a lot more transparent and a lot more obvious to the public and to the council when they're taking that action and what the implications of the change would be.
Anything else on this? We have two more items under this. We can push through and get it completed because I know everybody's waiting for their afternoon coffee break. Yeah, Ron, can we just finish up the two items and then?
Okay, I just know we can have other comments on the individual. We've had a number of presentations, but there's no
other comments. I was going to get to the end and then do it. Ann, do you want to do the workshop and then Pat will finish up?
All right, the chair asked me to give a brief summary of a workshop that we held on October 25th and 26th in Portland, which we called the Lessons Learned Workshop for Sectors. We're including this during the Touchstone Report item because of the format of this workshop. We tried to do something different than we normally do at council meetings and really use this as an opportunity to have a lot of interaction with the industry and get a lot of feedback from the industry about what the impacts were of the first year of sector management and what were their recommendations for improving the sector management system. And so in order to do that, I met with the sector managers and got some feedback from them about what issues they wanted to discuss during the meeting. And we decided to base the meeting around the issue groups that they had identified. We started the first morning with some analytical presentations. We had a review of expanded analyses in the Science Center's Groundfish Performance Report by the Science Center staff. We had staff from the regional office give a presentation summarizing the sector's annual reports and also talking about work that they've already done with the sectors to improve the regulatory process and to improve sector management. And then we had a presentation from council staff looking back on the goals and objectives of Amendment 16 and a brief summary of whether those had been met and which ones were still needing to be addressed with the sector system. After that, we had a full afternoon and a full morning of panel presentations in which the sector managers and fishermen from their sector, if they wished, came and sat on panels. They were organized around the six issue areas that the sector managers had identified. They were long-term visioning for sectors, monitoring, ACE trading and quota transfer and usage rules, data management, continuing effort controls that hamper fishing operations, and sector manager responsibility and improving communications with managers. The basic format of the panels was that the panelists, of which there were between 6 and 10 for each topic, sat in front of the room, and all of the attendees and participants, which included council members as well as fishermen and other industry members, the sector managers, the SSC, the Groundfish Advisory Panel, the Groundfish PDT, regional office staff that works on sectors, were all in the audience, all mixed together rather than how we normally do it at a council meeting. And the panelists were allowed to, or gave their presentations about what they wanted to say, and then we had a back-and-forth session with the audience in which, you know, all the participants were treated equally and everyone got to speak their mind and interact with the panelists. On the last afternoon, we had all the participants break into 5 breakout groups that were facilitated. We had 5 facilitators, and there were about 20 people in each group. And each of the groups was tasked with coming up with recommendations or potential solutions for the issues that had been identified during the panel presentations, and then to prioritize those recommendations. So in the end, we got a fairly long list of recommendations that the groups had recommended, but there were a couple that seemed to be the most common between groups or that the most people within groups had supported as council priorities for the next year or for as soon as possible. So there's a summary of the meeting and of the recommendations. It's included in the groundfish materials, I believe. So I guess you don't have to say, but it is on our website, and it'll be in the materials for tomorrow. In the end, there's just sort of a quick and dirty list of 4 or 5 main areas that people recommended for council action. And in the end, a lot of the groups recommended that we do something like this again because the sector managers came for 2 days but really got a lot of opportunity to speak and a lot of opportunity to interact with the council. And I think the feedback was pretty positive for that format.
Once again, thank you for all the work that you did on this. And the report is great. Thank you. Comments, questions for Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Ann. I think that was a great job. I think it was an overall success. Everybody worked together. Everybody had a better understanding of sectors when it was through, the workshop was through. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you. We're going to finish up with Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I also want to congratulate the council. I wasn't able to attend the workshop, but I've heard only positive feedback myself. I think it was a really good format and something that the council might want to think about using in the future as well. I wanted to take a minute during this discussion to talk a little bit about Eric Schwab's letter to RIP, his November 7th letter, which again congratulated the council on the workshop. Eric was able to attend part of it and had only good things to say about it. We also had Chris Mark Grant giving a presentation and many, many staff members participating. So we got quite a lot out of that. So combining that with, we'd also had a workshop with the sector managers at the end of August as a sort of a year-end wrap-up for us as well. And a lot of good suggestions out of both of those. And so we are moving forward with the things that we can do within our authority that don't require regulatory changes. And so looking at things like simplifying some of the reporting requirements, the frequency of the sector reports we're looking at, combining some multiple reports in some cases, specifically the VMS reports, revising the logbooks and trying to streamline that process a little bit more. And so we think there's clearly some opportunities for us to make improvements and streamline things and reduce redundancies. And so we're moving forward with that. Also looking at some of the communication issues and enhancing the guidance to the industry and to sector members and sector managers. And then generally working on communication issues. in addition, I wanted to talk about a couple of things that were specifically noted in Eric's letter. One of them is the rolling closures, the inshore rolling closures in the Gulf of Maine, and then the second one is the carryover provision. And we understand that the council is going to be discussing both of these during priorities tomorrow. The inshore rolling closures are being considered as part of the omnibus habitat amendment, and we strongly encourage the council to prioritize that and continue to move forward with that. And there'll be a discussion of the rollover as part of some of the groundfish actions. And we want to see the council move forward with that, too, in the longer term. In the shorter term, we have some opportunities to look at these through the operation plan approval process. And so we're going to do that. And so for the rolling closures and the carryover provision, we've had some requests from the sectors to both allow additional exemptions to some of the insurer rolling closures as well as to potentially increase the amount of the carryover that's authorized through the sector operations plans. So we're going to analyze those two things in the action, the proposed rule, and the NEPA analysis for the sector operations plans for the proposed approval of the 2012 sector operations plans. And we'll be seeking the council and public comment on those when we publish the proposed rule, which we expect to be around the January timeframe. And we're going to try really hard, and I think we should be able to do this without too much problems, make sure that the council meeting falls during that comment period, and then make a final decision about whether or not to allow any additional exemptions or likely on a stock-by-stock basis, look at the carryover issue and see if there are any opportunities for allowing additional carryover in 2012. When we public, and so we'd make a decision on that in the final rule for approval of the operations plans next spring sometime. So that timing should allow both the council meeting to fall during the public comment period, be able to get some public input into this, and it will also allow us to get the results of the Gulf of Maine cod assessment, hopefully, before we make any decisions. So I just did want to speak to those issues a little bit out of Eric's letter. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat. Questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, certainly I found the sector workshop to be useful. I was there for the first day. I couldn't be there for the second. Just a quick question regarding one of the key presentations that was given by the service. A mistake was made and acknowledged in one of the key slides relative to the amount of allocation by gear type, I think, or vessel size, and the amount of the allocation that actually was caught. Thanks to the service for catching that error, and then we made the change. But my question is that revised figure on the web, is it now... has it been substituted for the incorrect figure? Because people keep going to that website to see that presentation, and if that figure is still wrong, it needs to be corrected because it generated a lot of debate and caused a lot of confusion. And the correction that was made during the meeting was very valuable. So I just need to make sure that this issue is addressed.
That's a good question. Have you looked recently to see if it's still there?
No.
Let's put it this way. If it's still there, it'll be fixed before the end of this meeting, seriously. Because, it was something that was corrected during that meeting, and if it's still on the website, it shouldn't be.
Jim?
Yeah, it's been corrected. I checked it, but I was hoping there was going to be some kind of press release because there was a serious confusion on that, and I was hoping there would have been a little more follow-up to that, but I have since checked that it has been corrected on the website.
I think the press release was about the overall document, and I think I'm not sure that the issue in the document and the message in the press release changed at all. I think it was just an error in the slide. Okay, I'm wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't. All I thought we should release is something about the correction, because the perception that was had left the room when that slide with the error in it was on the screen got out of the room, and the correction has never gotten out of the room. In other words, it got in the press, the false information. And so just by correcting it on our website doesn't change anybody's perception of what was real. I don't know if I'm being clear, but in any event, it's not the original press release that you put out that was flawed. It was the perception that came out of the room by having a slide up there that was an error. So we need to let people know that there was an error and the perception is X. That this is the accurate one now, so that it's just out there a little better.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, one other point. Well, I'm glad Frank's going to take a look at it and see if it has been corrected. Jimmy indicates that it has, but confirming that would be very useful, because Jimmy is quite correct. People left the meeting thinking that that was the right information, and it was not. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure to what extent you want us to comment on the lessons learned themselves. Is that to be under Groundfish, or are you inviting some additional comments on the lessons learned summary document that we have?
Maybe we should do it under Groundfish. That's okay. At the end of the Groundfish presentation.
That's my preference, so.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go to the audience. Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. I had a couple of questions about the presentation on how to improve things. And regarding the regional office presentation, in looking in retrospect to Framework 22, for example, there was a lot of industry concern from the point where it left the council to many months later in July. It left the council in November, I think, and finally went into effect in July. And all during that period, no one had any idea what was holding it up, And we got different answers from different people. So that seems to be, to me, a clear example of a communications problem. And I was just wondering, it's been 25 years since I was in the regional office. When a document comes in and starts going through the process, does it get split up? In other words, is NEPA looking at it the same time the protected species is looking at it, same time legal is looking at it? So it's in multiple desks, if you will. It would seem to me that there should be posted on a website a much more detailed tracking of the document, and so that we know where it is, where the holdups are. It just seems that on one extreme, if it's too general, it's not providing a tremendous amount of information to those that are interested in the details. It would seem that a better approach would be to have a much more accurate tracking of the document, right down to names and desks. In other words, that it's, the reviewer in protected species or the reviewer in NEPA, that when it arrived at their desk and when it leaves their desk. Now, that's not too complicated a thing to do nowadays. I was just mentioning a couple of nights ago, my wife picked up my granddaughter at the horse barn and called in a pizza order to Domino's Pizza. I was on a computer, and an email came in tracking the pizza being made. I'm not kidding you. Domino, you could track your pizza being made, check your order number in real time. It would seem that a similar system could be done for tracking a framework document through the process. So just so the public knows what's going on and could also get an understanding of why it takes 9 months to do an action. So that, I think we need a sort of a retrospective analysis of that particular issue to get a better understanding of the time delays and the issues that the regional office has to confront in getting a management measure through. The only other major comment, other than adding "and Danish" to the coffee thing, is the collaborative working sessions. I mean, we definitely have a problem in collaborating on solving problems. Back when we did the Seastead project years ago, we were going through a council process that was dragging on for about 15 months on choosing the site for the Seastead project. It was only when the council said, this project's going to happen, you guys decide where it's going to happen, and Rodney put together a meeting in New Bedford between the project people and the fishermen. Within 1 hour, we had a decision made. And it was sort of a working group phenomenon. But we knew what the problem was clearly stated. And that seems to be a lot of issues with management measures. We learn in engineering that 50% of a solution to a problem is properly identifying the problem. We're not making adequate use of the advisory panels. We have a plan development team, but in this document, you barely see the mention of the advisory panels in the process. And we're not correctly identifying the problems at the initial stage. In other words, what should be the next management action in a particular FMP and getting that group together early on. I mean, it's sort of identified here, but it should be more, you know, advisory panels. And it says, you know, help encourage industry to develop management solutions. True, that takes money. I mean, how do you encourage industry to develop a management solution? Industry could come in and identify a problem. We've, in Framework 18, we identified a problem in the scallop that you are not properly assessing the biomass in the open areas. We, you know, and every year we were exceeding our targets because the total underestimation of the scallops in the open areas. In a turtle issue, the industry identified the problem 2 years before NIMS knew it existed, and the industry knew that it had to take action. So while this is probably the key here, the collaborative working sessions, or we need to actually figure out how to do that. And I think the technique is bring that advisory panel in early with the PDT and say, okay, what are the problems here? Which ones should we address? What are the directions? So it's just making more use of your advisory panels, which I think is really understated in this document. So those are the 2 points.
Thank you, Ron. Anyone else? Back to the council. Dave?
Yeah, I had a question for Pat. At the sector workshop, we were told that the sectors couldn't apply for an exclusion to, like, the rolling closures unless the PDT analyzed it. And the reason they'd all been denied is because the PDT hadn't analyzed it. By what you said, does that mean that we, the council, have to request the PDT today to start analyzing this so it'll be done in time, or are we going to just waive that requirement?
Yeah, I think part of the problem was that the council, as you know, exempted some areas. So there's these automatic exemptions. And then the implication was there's a good reason why these other areas haven't been exempted. And so our argument has been the council decided not to exempt them. They should really go through the council process of deciding they should be exempted or they're potentially could be authorized for exemption. And so now you're right. What we're saying instead is we're going to try to expedite this, try to, I forget what the word is he's used in here, but sort of kickstart some of these things. We're going to take the initiative to analyze the potential for some of these rollover areas, rolling closure areas. I keep getting the two mixed up, the rollover and the rolling closure. The rolling closure areas in this rule, but you know, we do want to be careful about that and be clear that we want on the 10% rollover, we're specifically asking the SSC to look at it. And we may come back and ask the SSC to look at the analysis for the rollover provisions, the rollover closures, too. So, so no, you do not have to ask the PDT to do it. I think the rationale in the past has been there. You know, the council had a good reason for not allowing it, and we didn't want to preempt that. And so now we're trying to find a process that allows this to be expedited. We'll do the analysis, but we'll still include the council to the extent that we can to make sure that any concerns they have are there's an opportunity to express
that. That's great. I mean, I applaud it. I think that's the way we should move forward, and I do think the SSC should review those. I mean, especially on the rollovers on a stock-by-stock basis, because I'm not comfortable with just saying blanket increase it to 25% across the board, especially if it's a stock that may be going down rapidly, as an example. The rolling closures, I think we've demonstrated the way forward there is with these dedicated spawning stock closures like the one off of New Hampshire, and I would hope that if we identify more areas, we could move in that direction and eliminate the rolling closures. But I do think having the SSC review them is a logical way to proceed.
Doug Grout and Dave Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up for clarification on my part the comments that were made concerning that slide that was in error at the sector workshop that was showed the ACE that was allocated by vessel size and what was actually caught. When I talked to the author that caught that particular error, he said that the error was also in the report, the performance report. And that there would be, I asked, and he said that there would be a revised report that would be distributed or sent out that would say 2010 final report revised. If you could check in, because I think it, at least according to my conversation with him, it wasn't just the slide that was shown, but there was also the error in the report. I think it's on table 23, so that I can make sure I know what information is correct and what isn't. And if it is in the report, if you could send out the report with a revised report and a press release saying this was incorrect and this is the correct one. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave?
Yeah, Pat, Mr. Chairman, Pat, you summarized the points made by Eric Schwab in his letter to us regarding the sector workshop, and of course he ended his letter by highlighting the possible problem we might have with Gulf of Maine cod, and he indicates that there likely will have to be a discussion of potential management responses to deal with that possible outcome with Gulf of Maine cod. In light of the fact that, to your credit, to the service's credit, you're kickstarting things and looking at the rolling closure exemption, the request for further exemptions, can we assume that you'll be, as part of that kickstart and examination, that you'll also be factoring in what might come out of that Gulf of Maine cod assessment? In other words, will that play a role in whether or not you agree that the rolling closure exemptions that are being sought after should be approved?
The timing is difficult, and so, as I said, we are mindful that the assessment will be available, the results of the assessment will be available before we have to make a decision on the rolling closures. whether or not we're able to actually incorporate the analysis, I think, is going to be more difficult just because of the timing. So it needs to be part of any final decision that's made. And to the extent that we can, we'll take it into consideration in the sector rule and in the analysis. But I'm not sure we'll have it in time to have the information we'll really need to make an informed decision.
Oh, Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I just wanted to publicly thank the agency for the letter from Eric Schwab, in which he indicates that he's willing to take a fresh look at the request for exemptions from the rolling closures. And I just wanted to say that there are a number of other kinds of exemptions that people have requested, and we're hoping that the agency will look at those with a fresh look as well. Just for example, we've asked to be able to fish in the closed area to Haddock Sap on May 1st with trawl gear instead of on August 1st, and there doesn't, you know, that seems to be a fairly straightforward request. You know, we just really appreciate that the rolling closures are going to be looked at. We firmly believe that providing more access to the small day boats, to the fish that they're allocated, will have a huge impact on protecting their ability to stay in the fishery. With regard to the potential impact on Gulf of Maine cod, I would just point out that no one's having any trouble catching Gulf of Maine cod now with all the areas closed. So I think, you know, you need to look at those areas in terms of what other fish is available for the fleet to target that they can't get at now, especially the day boats and the rolling closures. That the fish is only in those areas during that time. And so they need to be able to have access to those areas in order to catch the dabs and the pollock and the haddock that they're allocated. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take a break until 4:15.